Tonight's presentation is without precedent. The response, all of you, is evident of just how important the artist Frank Stella is to our understanding and our appreciation of art's evolution over the past 5 decades. Tonight's showing and all of the excitement leading up to it is a tribute to art's capacity to engage in this artist's enduring relevance over a long and oh-so-productive career. I am thrilled that there is this much enthusiasm for the development of ideas and challenges of perception as realized in the work of Mr. Stella, one of America's most important and, I have to say, tenacious living artists. As you know, tonight's lecture is a preview for Frank Stella, a retrospective, opening to the public this coming Sunday, and having debuted last fall at the Whitney Museum of American Art, where it was the Whitney's first solo exhibition in their new space. The exhibition, which has been met with a great deal of critical acclaim, was curated by this museum's very own chief curator, Michael Oppie. Someone who, as many of you know, can be counted on to garner a large and enthusiastic audience in his own right, making Michael and Frank Stella the dynamic duo which accounts for tonight's overflow crowd. I would be amiss if I did not take this opportunity to let you know that signed copies of the beautiful and very insightful catalog with essays by Michael Oppie, the Whitney's director, Adam Weinberg, and Jordan Cantor, as well as an interview between Frank Stella and the artist Laura Owens, are available while they last in the modern store, which on this occasion has agreed to be open for a while after the lecture. It is important to note that Michael Oppie and Frank Stella have been working on this exhibition for some time. And tonight, we are very fortunate to be the beneficiaries of a relationship that is built through this process and the stories they have to share as we listen to a conversation acknowledging important historic markers as well as heralding exciting new works and ideas. Please join me in showing our appreciation as we welcome Frank Stella and Michael Oppie.
Good evening.
Yes. Thank you. Whoops, wrong way. So, Frank, I thought we would start in the present rather than the past and go right to a slide of your current studio in Newburgh, New York, which when I first went there 6 years ago really surprised me because here I was visiting the father of minimalism. And I saw a studio that was anything but minimal. And how did it start from a small studio on East Broadway to this? This is literally, this studio is approximately 1 square acre enclosed.
Well, I mean, the easiest explanation is in a small studio, and as a younger man, I could move the paintings around. In this studio, we have overhead cranes to move the pieces, so it's a fairly natural evolution if you keep on working.
This is the most recent work in the exhibition, and I wanted to start with it and then maybe go backwards. And if I'm correct, Frank, this was developed out of partly handwork, but working with a CAD program. And then, is this 3D printing? Was this made with...
That's 3D? What they call it, yeah, rapid prototyping. And actually, the rapid prototyping is a bit tricky because it's not that rapid. But it is basically a fairly new technique, although we were using it, and other people were using it, of course, in the 80s. But the advantage of it is that it can deal with very complicated intersections of parts that can be still, could be done manually, but it's not very likely that you can get them to be fabricated anymore because the fabricators all work from files, computer files, and aren't really interested in the model that you make them. So you have to deal with what the going way of building is. That's really what it's about, how you build something.
Well, I think a lot of people who see the current work in this exhibition, and particularly my generation, who consider you the father of minimalism and very simple linear designs, look at this and are a little confused. But having worked with you for 6 years, I've turned a corner, and I actually think this is a kind of distorted version of a black painting. It's almost a congealed darkness to this
piece.
Well,
you could say it was twisted into parts and pieces. But one of the things that's interesting about the process and the development of techniques is it's not all that, from the artist's point of view, fabulous. I mean, what's interesting about this piece is if you look at it, you can see it's in three parts. And it wasn't designed to be that way. But because that's the limit of the size of the machines that are available for the printing, that's how it came out. We could have glued the parts all together and it could have been one piece, but someone, and I'm not sure who it was, had the idea of mounting them on these clear plastic plates and then bolting the plates together. And for some unusual reason, it didn't look all that bad, although I thought it was a really bad idea. We haven't done it since.
Now I want to go back to 1958 and explore this darkness a little more. This is a painting that Frank did called East Broadway in 1958, right after he graduated from Princeton, and you were in a small studio. And I guess that what I'd like to ask, I've always wanted to ask, is so what is that dark shape about in the center of this painting and the beginning of these stripes? Where...
Well, the bands were always there from a few paintings before. And the idea of the band really came from a sense of the surface that you were working on, which was the canvas, and using what are known as the house painter's tools or equipment. It's really just the path of the brush from one side of the canvas to the other. Mm-hmm. And if you alternate the colors, you get a kind of pattern one way or the other. And you can see it's not too fussy about it. But I think that there's something else, but which is not exactly accidental, but not so worrisome, at least to me, when I was doing it. This is a kind of landscape painting in a certain sense, but it's an urban landscape painting. So the shape that is in... or integrated in some way, or not integrated, depending on how you look at it, with the bands is a rectangle. And the rectangle could be a lot of things. It could be a doorway. It could be it could be a building. It could be just about anything. But it's basically rectilinear, and it's basically something about the way the city functions. And the colors are kind of obvious. The yellow and black is the asphalt and the taxi cab and whatever. Mm-hmm. That's the feeling of the city.
Well, one of the things that always impressed me about you as a young artist was that you were very upfront about early influences. And a lot of the minimalists were not. And you always said that seeing Jasper John's paintings of flags at Leo Castelli's gallery in 1958 had an effect on you, and that it helps you to understand how to compose a picture without it being what they called relational painting. Balance a small yellow thing with a large dark thing in the lower right-hand corner. This was a way of organizing the composition.
Yeah, I think it's true in a way, but actually it wasn't what really influenced me. The influence of Jasper was in the painting from, it might have been 56 or 57 in the Jewish Museum, which was the Green Target. Mm. And that was actually, it's hard to believe, way more sensational than the painting of the American flag. And that painting was, since it's a target, the idea is the repetition, the concentric squares, the concentric circles in that painting. That was the idea. And then the flag just sort of opened it up, and you can see it. In the painting that we saw before, although this painting might, I don't know what the date of that.
This is 58.
Yeah.
But the literature on your on your paintings, since you did mention John's, seems to go into the fact that John's...
Well, there's no getting around it. There's a lot of things. I think probably Jasper is more influential as a force and as a new idea happening in New York at the time than maybe even the formal aspects of the painting. I mean, it's the drama that's about the idea that something new can happen and it can change dramatically in the face of what was fantastically important and kind of heavy painting of abstract expressionism of the 50s and before.
But I do think what this exhibition shows, this retrospective, because we don't have a pure room of black paintings, is that what I've noticed is that there's really much more of the feeling of abstract expressionism. This is a photograph by Hollis Frampton. It was a series of photographs that Frank collaborated with Hollis on called The Secret World of Frank Stella. And it's Frank standing out front of the Cedar Bar, which was the watering hole for the abstract expressionists. This is where they all drank, and this is where they discussed their art. I don't know if you ever went to the Cedar Bar. I never...
I spent a bit of time there.
Okay.
But actually, this is a little bit interesting in terms of the photograph. I mean, this is a play on a very famous photograph by Fred McDara, which has, and ironically, I didn't think of it until I saw it here, but Franz Kline and de Kooning are standing in pretty much the same place. And what you see is the rear of a young lady there and... And a famous critic standing to the left. So you see the whole scene, Ruth Kligman, as it were, with Harold Rosenberg. And that was a very typical scene. But ironically, I mean, it's not irony, actually, but they were wearing sort of, they didn't have moth-eaten clothes. I mean, they actually had normal clothing on. But this was one step in the direction of the beatniks, I guess.
Well, I show it because what I've come to see over studying your pictures longer and longer is to, rather than looking at Jasper Johns, that your admiration for a number of the abstract expressionists really comes out in those early pictures. So on the left is a 1950 painting by Robert Motherwell.
Yeah, that's in the modern. I knew that painting, and it was reproduced an awful lot then, too.
And then on the right is a painting by Frank. So, and Motherwell was creating this space within this prison-like structure. And then I always felt with, not until I saw this picture, a certain appreciation on your part for Rothko that I think a number of your generation didn't see or didn't feel, maybe.
Well, it's a little bit hard to say. I mean, one of the things is that there was an idea and it just, was completely wrong, that the black paintings were, in fact, very unpopular. But that didn't mean that they were against abstract expressionism, which was popular at the time. It so happened, as you point out, they're plenty close to Motherwell and Rothko, for example. And they were that way, not so much that they were meant to be that way, but that they couldn't be anything else. Mm-hmm. There wasn't room for them to be anything other than what they were, and which was paintings of their time. And they represented one thing that was a little bit difficult, because abstract expressionism, given that the painting itself was so important and so good, represented what was called at the time existential anxiety. Mm-hmm. And it worked both ways. It was a kind of put down as well as a kind of explanation of what the intellectual attitude behind the work was supposed to be. But that's simply explained in just one, I won't bore you with the obvious, but the Depression, the Second World War, the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and the Holocaust, those kinds of things that people live through, they lived through it as an adult and experienced it. I was, like a lot of other people, a young man. I only had some vague idea about it. I mean, I didn't know exactly what it meant, but it was a big part of their life. And then functioning as artists in a community that was really quite self-enclosed, so it didn't have much play on the outside or interaction. So it was still a small world.
And when you debuted the black paintings in 1959, and then you were put in the 16 Americans exhibition, which was unheard of for most people felt unheard of for someone as young as you to be in a show with Johns and Rauschenberg and Diebenkorn, and I forget who else was in that show. But what the literature?
Evelson, actually, there was another black.
Right.
There was another black painter in that show.
That's a good point.
Black 3D, anyway.
But the theorists who talk about your black paintings talk about them as these conceptual gestures and these very dry material facts. When I think there is more atmosphere when you see this exhibition, you know, many of you, this will be the first time you've ever seen a Frank Stella black painting in person. I know it took me a long time to see one. You know, if go to MoMA and see The Marriage of Reason and Squalor. But you also, they have this incredible pull, your black paintings. But then you did some kind of radical things. Like this painting is called Diphana Hawk, which means high-flying flag. And that is a song that became the anthem for the Nazi Party, which is a pretty radical thing to do in the face of these, you know, this generation before you who had just experienced World War II. I mean, was that... that's tough to answer. I don't know.
No, I mean, it came from the newsreels. I mean, and it's the proportions of the piece that it's the conventional Nazi flag hanging from the hanging from the balconies,
right,
was roughly that kind of proportion, red with the white circle and the black swastika. And but it wasn't in the newsreels, of course, it was black and white. And it was an image that was repeated over and over again. So the form, in a certain sense, was there.
Did you ever get hammered by anybody and say, you know, this is a Nazi anthem? I'm just curious if you did. I mean,
no, nobody paid any attention.
Okay.
Actually, I mean, the titles went unmentioned or unnoticed until Brenda Richardson did a show of the black paintings in 1973, and then the repercussions. They started to talk about it, and there was this idea that. Basically, this kind of symmetry and these ideas, you could imagine these paintings are,
right,
as, you know, having some element of directing your attention and controlling you and being basically fascistic.
You know, it wasn't until I had to really start writing about this work that it also dawned on me that you could have been referring to Johns. The high-flying
You're not the only one who said that.
Oh, okay. I thought I was.
That's true, but it wasn't in my mind.
Okay.
I mean, I guess in a certain sense it's obvious. And some of the other things, you know, there's a problem with being young, and not that it has anything really to do with being young, but having an idea about what you want to do and sort of following it through. So if you follow the idea through with the black paintings, they were basically dark, industrial, and you know, prone to disaster or destruction or whatever you want to call it, burnt out quality. One was called the Reichstag. So that things are, you know, there, and you it's hard not to pick up on something like Arbeit macht frei, which is, if you're a person or a young person, you know, the idea that work is going to make you free has a kind of grotesque irony.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to resist. But again, nobody bothered about that. But in 1973, a woman did call me on it. She was a survivor, and she said, "How do I know what side you're on?" And,
mm-hmm,
you know, it was perfectly legitimate.
Hmm. Well, I don't want to spend too much time on the black paintings, although you know I love them. And I was curious, I mean, how you painted the black paintings also became a huge story behind the paintings themselves. So here we have a painting by of Jackson Pollock painting, a photograph by Hans Nahmuth. And Jackson Pollock slinging paint in this sort of ritualistic gesture in this barn on Long Island. And Frank making his black paintings, in which he's going with one line. He's simply painting right around the edges. And they had almost a Samuel Beckett-like quality that I think really affected people. How could we go, you know, in one generation from that to that? But
it's very close to Rothko. And I mean, I'm not so sure what they... these photographs came out a little later. I'm not sure anyone knew how I painted them because they said they were white lines on black canvas.
True. That photograph of Frank was really taken in 71, 72 by Hollis Frampton.
No, it wasn't. It was shown then, but it was taken.
Oh, okay. It was taken in 59.
Taken in 59.
So we'll
when I actually painted it. But anyway.
That's when it was printed. So we'll paint our way out of these black paintings just so people can see.
But, you know, I mean, I didn't see it before either, but that's the same can of paint that Pollock has, right, nearby him?
Right. Both using enamel?
The paint is in the can. It's not on the palette. It's not anywhere. So he's got it on a stick and he's throwing it, but I just have it on the brush and putting it down.
And that paint is enamel paint?
Yes.
And why did you choose enamel paint?
Well, partly because it was 99 cents a gallon. It was the best. But I was familiar with house paint and with enamel and everything. And also, there's a little bit that you can say, with I don't want to overdo it. But, you know, I thought of it in a funny way. It was Mr. Clean was very popular then. I thought of it as industrial strength painting, to use conventional commercial paints. But, you know, again, there was a precedent for that. Obviously, the enamel with Pollock, and Pollock again, and with other painters before with the aluminum paint. There was a lot of talk about Duco enamel, and it was in the air, if not in the cedar bar conversation.
Was it harder to paint with, do you think, than oil? Heavier?
No, a lot easier.
Easier?
Yeah.
Okay.
And intensely cheaper. I mean, that.
Well, I think, you know, if you look through your archives and you see these drawings that you did of black and aluminum paintings, it looks like they were extremely deliberate, as though, well, you did these drawings, then you made the paintings exactly like the drawings. But then, you know, when we look at paintings like Delta, where it looks like it's a transition, like the move to the black paintings was more organic than just conceptual, right?
Yeah, that was a painting like the early painting that you showed, which is basically a two- or three-color painting. And this was obviously a red and black painting at one time. And then I painted it out and because, you know, I was annoyed with it for one reason or another. And as they say, the next day it didn't look that bad. So I went on from there.
And the next series, the aluminum series, not only are you painting, as you did with the black paintings, to echo the shape of the rectangular canvas, but now you're actually shaping the canvas itself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a simple story behind that, too. I mean, the drawings that you showed before are were diagrams, and the point I was interested in having the band not be so straight or not follow a kind of straight line, have it have some activity, which is the jog. But I don't know how it, anyway, in the earlier drawings, it ends up with a square in the corners, or the notches are filled in. And so I was talking with Darby Bannard, who was working down in Princeton at the store, and I said, but I like the idea, I like the way it moves, but you know, it ends up, I don't like how it ends in the corners there or in the middle. And he said, well, if you don't like it, take it away. And that was the level of my ability with carpentry to make a notch. And so I did it. I took it away, and then it became a different idea.
So did you stretch this painting yourself?
Yeah, believe it or not.
Okay, because
It's not that hard. I mean, yeah. It's a little bit.
And then you start taking corners out of the pictures and sections out of the sides. And then you do an even more radical thing, which is create a hole in the center of it.
Yeah, but
which exposes
it's not,
the wall.
I mean, it's only radical once you give in to the geometry of the jog. So it's given. It's going to end that way, and you take out that part.
Right. But there was something also about acknowledging the wall behind the painting and a certain kind of literal space within painting. Is that your hand coming out of that?
That's Hollis's.
Is that Hollis's hand? But that, to me, that says something about your sense of the reality of the space that hole created within the painting.
Yeah, it says a lot about how we had a lot of time on our hands.
Yeah. And then with the copper paintings, you start to take away so much of the painting that there's more wall than painting itself, it seems to me, with these Creed pictures. And I remember Saul LeWitt told me once that those were really critical to acknowledging the wall as the ground, as the pictorial ground for painting at that point.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, it may be for some people, but for me, it didn't really have much to do with that. It was about shaping and about what are the limits of shaping given a rectilinear bent. So you're taking away from the rectangle or the square. And this got to be about as much as I thought you could take away and still have it pictorial. But right. It's very close to what the whole idea of, I suppose, what minimalism came to be, but in the sense of worrying about how literal something is. And these were not sculptures, okay? But they were very close to being sculpture right. or wall relief. And the reason that they were close is not so much in the way they're diagrammed or laid out, but was in the actual material, which is, you had aluminum paint, which is metallic and that thing, but this is copper paint for basically used for as an anti-fouling cover for the bottom of boats, and it's really hard to manipulate, and the paint and the actual copper builds up, and so it made a different kind of surface. I mean, it's not much of a you know, it's different from the way paint or almost any kind of paint reacts, and so it's very close to being, say, one color or a sheet of metal or something like that. It's about as object-like as you can
right.
get it with painting and still be a painting.
And some of your good friends were sculptors. I mean, and you know, this is from Frank's archives. There are these drawings that Frank did that are on stationery from the desk of Carl Andre, a sculptor who Frank knew. He went to Andover, right, with with Carl, and you shared
and
a studio in Hollis, and you shared a studio briefly. Was that about when was that?
Yeah, they were in my studio, as it were.
Well,
because they didn't have any place else to go. Yes, but that's true, yeah.
And years ago, Carl acknowledged your influence on his work a lot, and he tells a great story in which he was making these sculptures, these carved sculptures in his studio, and they were carved on one side and flat on the back. And Carl said he invited Frank over to look at them.
That's my studio. He invited me to be in my own studio.
That's Carl Andre's sculpture and this studio you shared. And Carl, he didn't invite you to see it. He wanted you to see it. And you looked at the sculpture. This is according to Carl. And you walked around it and said, well, you know, sculpture's on the back, too.
Mm-hmm. That was a hint to take it away.
It changed. He claims it changed the way he worked after that to see the whole thing as sculpture, not just as sort of sculpture as a pictorial thing. And then I find an incredible symbiotic relationship between this show of your work and this show at Dwan Gallery 5 years later by Carl Andre. It's almost like a positive negative in which Carl Andre is using bricks to define a voidal space in the floor, and Frank is using paintings to sort of define the space of the wall. But this was in the Castelli.
Yeah, that's in Leo's gallery.
Right.
And I think one of the really interesting things about that is that space is about 25 by 25 feet. And when you see these exhibitions in museums, the space in which these paintings are shown is probably 2, 3 right. to 5 times greater than the actual way they were experienced, the way they were painted and the way they were shown, and perhaps meant to be shown.
I'm also interested in the relationship between your work and particularly your experimentation with color and pop art. And this is a series of small paintings by Frank that are in the show called Benjamin Moore Series, titled after Benjamin Moore House Paint, which was a very popular house paint at the time. Got the good housekeeping seal of approval.
They're quite still popular now. They have way more shades, but anyway.
And these paintings were purchased by Andy Warhol. And to me, I think that your experimentation with color in the very early 60s I think Warhol saw that as something that he wanted to engage in too. I mean, I just think it's fascinating that he bought those. And you said he paid $300 for all six, $50 a piece.
I didn't pay any tax then. Free and clear. Yes, but I mean, this is a good one. This the same thing. I mean, I did suffer quite a bit. I don't want to feel sorry for myself, but I was for a while inevitably became an abstract pop artist, and that was kind of brutal to my sensibility.
I wasn't sort of thinking that so much as that you affected pop more than they may have acknowledged through your experimentation with color. Not that you were being an abstract
I
pop
had nothing,
artist.
I like pop art, actually. Yeah. That wasn't a problem.
And this is a painting called Marrakesh. And were you the first sort of serious New York painter to use fluorescent and Day-Glo paints?
I don't know. I mean, because, people have been using whatever's available almost all the time. So I don't remember, but I mean, there was a lot of fluorescent paint in Jim Rosenquist pieces and stuff. I mean, it wouldn't have showed up exactly the same way, but it was being used.
True. And this was 64, this painting.
Yeah.
And then you begin to use color with this painting, Jasper's Dilemma, in which it's almost like you're using color to confuse the viewer's optics. So that there's concentric bands of color moving into the center.
It's upside down, too. But anyway.
Oh.
That's all right.
Sorry. I bet that isn't the first time that's happened.
No, it is. Hardly.
So apparently you weren't confused by them at all. But some of us get confused by them. And then on the right are these concentric bands of gray. So it's almost like you're forcing me to look at this thing with one eye on one side, one eye on the other side, and it sometimes they're hard to look at. Were you thinking?
Well, I don't think that they are maybe hard to look at, but I think I couldn't avoid the idea of people talk about how you see things and how you see paintings and everything, and. Behind everything somehow lurks the idea of representation and the notion of how things look right and how depth is experienced and all of that. And so you have perspective on one hand as a kind of given, which is the vision out the window. And then on the other side, on the other hand, you have the photograph, which supposedly gets everything right. But the photograph and in a certain way perspective are monocular. And I couldn't help, fooling around with the idea of using both eyes or having two images.
Well, what's really interesting to me is that even at this early stage, while you were moving into minimalism and influencing minimalist painting, you're still thinking about pictorial ideas. You never left the idea of investigating what looking at a picture is about. Not just an object on the wall, but, how the eye wants to move into a picture or a picture advancing out or having a painting that seems to move laterally along the wall.
Yeah, I think that, all the time. I mean, there are a number of ways that you can make a painting active or in some ways, movement, the paintings have to have a sense of vitality one way or the other. And there are a lot of ways you can achieve that, but having it move literally is one of the ways.
And what this slide for some does not show, I don't think, when you see this is the first painting you see when you enter the exhibition, is how the painting buckles, that there's illusion to this painting, that you didn't give up illusion. While a lot of abstract painters were saying, oh no, this thing has to be completely flat. It has to look flat, it has to feel flat. Your paintings had undulation in them that kept the eye moving.
Well, I didn't believe it. I mean, I pretended it was flat.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you see this, it doesn't look flat in person.
It does to me. I want it to look flat.
Well, we'll let that...
Sometimes you have to use the power of will.
Well, you all go in there on Saturday and Sunday to look at it, and you let me know if you think it looks flat. And then you had this breakthrough with the irregular polygon series. It seemed to be a breakthrough for you, in which you were making the paintings thicker. I mean, with this painting, the stretchers are like this thick now, so it really has a feeling of an object. But you have, but it's such an unusual shape, and now you're really, I mean, many people thought of Frank as the father of the shaped painting. Certainly not of the shaped painting per se, but the shaped abstract painting. Frank was the first one that most people think of. And it was a fairly radical shape. This to me looks like it's folding. It doesn't look like a flat object to me. It looks like it's folding in space. It looks like a Jacob's ladder or some form of origami almost. But maybe, that wasn't at all on your mind.
No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't on your mind.
It doesn't look that way to me either.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'm inventing a whole new way of seeing this thing. And then there's Chokura, which maybe I should ask you, what were you thinking in terms of this show?
Actually, it's very straightforward. And the issue is geometric painting, mm-hmm. and basically the history of geometric painting in the 20th century. And geometric painting consisted in most part of dividing up an area. Although I don't look at Mondrian that way, but you can see the idea of how Mondrian has divided the space. And it became an issue of how space was organized and how it was, in a sense, composed, but basically on a flat surface. And a typical example of that was a Malevich painting, which, you know, I couldn't get out of my head, which is which I think is in the Stedelijk now. But anyway, it's a blue rectangle, and on the right-hand side is a blue
black
triangle. And the triangle is laid over the top of the black rectangle. So that's a conventional way that geometric painting works. You have one thing on top of each other or one thing beside each other. And the idea here is basically the same idea, but something happened when I was working on the drawings, and what happens here is that the triangle, I hate to use this word, but moves into or penetrates the square or the rectangle. And the result is it could still be shaped, and it could still be, mm-hmm. if it were one color, if it were, say, just a red triangle sticking into the green square, not much would really happen. It would be a little bit different, but there wouldn't be something there that is there because of following the yellow band that goes around framing the green part, accepting the gray and red triangle that comes into it. And we call that, or the engineers call that, spring-loaded. So there's the sense that the triangle really is moving in to the green area, and the yellow is a kind of buffer or something, and it could be expelled. So there's a kind of sense that's a little bit away from a kind of conventional relationship or flatness or how the parts would be together. And that was seemed to me a way of looking at geometry that was a little different from the way it was being done.
And then you move into these are probably some of your most famous paintings, or people who know even very little about contemporary art or contemporary abstraction know of your protractor paintings. And how did it come about that you went into the curve and to use a protractor?
You know, the kids had the protractors were around, but I was fooling around with it. But I think the real reason that it happened was that the irregular polygons kind of ran out in a way. They didn't expand. I mean, they could be quite dramatic and quite dynamic within a contained field, and they didn't have a way of spreading out. I tried a lot of things actually in drawing stuff that you don't see, and I was sort of in a certain way disappointed that I couldn't go anywhere with it. So I just switched gears, as they say, or just started working on something else. And the protractors just presented themselves in a way that was on one hand kind of obvious, and on the other hand, you know, something happened when, in the fooling around with the drawing, that reminded me of a medieval manuscript illumination, some of the kind of interlacing things that happened in, say, the Irish and in decorative art in the early medieval times.
Which, and Frank, at Princeton, you, as a junior, you wrote a paper on illuminated manuscript paintings, in which you started to compare Pollock with illuminated.
That was three lines.
It was a pretty radical
the problems of kingship in Irish Carolingian and Ottonian manuscript illumination, which was a conventional Princeton art paper, art historical paper. Anyway, yes, I did mention Pollock.
So, which was, I thought, good.
And the rest of it, my ideas about kingship weren't that interesting, I guess.
So here's the, just to show that. But I wanted to ask you about, here's thinking about Pollock and et cetera. But I also wanted to, I'm going the wrong way. I wanted to ask you about the white bands between the colors and how that functions. In a lot of your pictures, you make sure that there is a thin band of either canvas or white between a band of color. And why is that?
You could say a lot of things, but I mean, because in a certain way, they could be hard-edged paintings. They could be up against each other, but they're really not, largely because that's very hard to do. You get a little bit of space, as it were. But the idea comes right out of Matisse and out of the Red Studio. And that was terrifically effective somehow and influenced me. The idea of the negative line taking the place of positive drawing just seemed to really work for me and seemed to be, you know, have a lot of, it was easily adaptable in a lot of situations. And it was one way of avoiding what was seen at the time as a big problem, which was drawing with paint. And so it was just a way to, so that you wouldn't, it actually was kind of a way of avoiding Picasso, so you didn't have to outline things in black and move around. So that was the kind of sense that you got from Matisse. It's a way of freeing up the color in a certain sense because you don't have the linear outline.
This is a painting that's in the exhibition entitled Damascus Gate, and it's huge. I forget exactly how.
It's 50 feet long. But it's only 10 feet tall.
And I think I think what some people have forgotten and that this retrospective really shows is how you really pushed the limits of scale in abstract painting. I mean, this may be one of the largest indoor abstract paintings ever made. And I think, you know, that was something that you seemed to be very interested in doing.
Yeah, but by the time I made this picture, I was really aware and had, I mean, it compared to what was called decorative painting and everything, I mean, compared to the painting that you can see on walls and what happens in European painting or just, for example, in the Louvre, I mean, 19th century French painting, I mean, the paintings are gigantic. I mean, there have been, and for a long time, a tradition of large work for whatever reason.
But you did title this after a number of these pictures after ancient architecture. I mean, this is Damascus Gate, the gate into Jerusalem.
There was a fellow named Cresswell who did a study of Islamic architecture, but it was about the circular cities in the Near East that had a circular city plan, basically. It's the idea of a city contained by a wall, but by a circular wall.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like this is when you really start to get very interested in architecture and the relationship between architecture and painting or creating relationships.
Well, I think that's probably true, but I didn't know it.
And then in 1970, Frank had a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He was 34? 34.
How can I tell? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, 34.
I'm older now, so
you were 34
matter.
Years old, and many considered that amazing that MoMA would give a retrospective to an artist that young. And at the same time, you had some knee surgery. You were laid up in the hospital, and then coincidentally, the architect Richard Meyer. So Frank is getting more involved in architecture. Gives him a book on.
The Polish synagogues.
And this is an image from that book. And you started doing drawings in the hospital, and then from the drawings you went very quickly to materials, which you always seem to do, into these crazy constructed maquettes. And then you blast into the Polish Village series, which is, you know, you worked very long on those.
Yeah. Well, the one thing we don't see here, I mean, that's the image of the synagogue before it was burned down. But in the discussion of them after the war, and they were reconstructive diagrams of it's really the geometry inside the synagogue which is really the most interesting, and it's really a kind of. I don't know how to put it, but it's woodworking and wood construction brought to a very high level mm-hmm. of complexity and actually interest. So, I mean, they are wooden, but it's they're really formed by the wood, and the shape represents the ability to put things together with wood.
I mean, it almost seems at this point in the career, you know, in the early 70s, that you're actually building paintings rather than painting paintings, at least in the beginning. And in some cases, you know, you work with just, this is wood.
That's fabricated, yeah. But anyway, that's what it was supposed to be.
And then you do get involved with color. But the paintings they're painted, but they're actually, when you see this painting in the exhibition, you need to look at it carefully because you'll see that it's layers of things. So the color is not just paint against an edge of paint. It's actually a section of maybe canvas or another material laid down in a color.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of materials. I mean, this one happens to be just canvas, but some of them have homey materials like homosote and press board and whatnot.
I show this because I've never seen you that relaxed ever before.
And I haven't.
I found this photograph, and I just had to show it. But he's worn out from making these Polish Village things. He's building constantly, hammering.
The only really interesting thing about that is it's still there. That's a Tex-Mex restaurant on Houston Street now. And they haven't really done much to it. The floor's pretty much the same as it. Anyway.
And that painting on the right-hand side.
Oh, yeah, that's in the show, yeah.
That's in the show, Karmelenka.
But there is one other slightly interesting thing. I mean, you can see that we're working a lot, and a lot of people are working on it. And some of the people who worked on them are here tonight. But nonetheless, while we're working, you can see the other models there, and that's for the Brazilian painting. So, I mean, ideas flow together. I mean, so we don't just work on one thing at a time. Or one thing leads to another in a very obvious and direct way.
I show this slide because in regards to the relationship between painting and architecture, this slide does not do this justice at all. But so you need to look at this carefully in the exhibition. So it's a series of layers of materials that Frank has brought together, but the painting is also embedded into the wall. And this is the first time with the Whitney showing in here that you've been able to do that, right?
Well, the piece being put into the wall is a play on the actual surface of the painting, which is in front of most of the activity in the painting. It's a kind of bas relief,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Beautiful painting. And then in the 80s, I mean, many of the artists of my generation, you know, they were looking for someone, a hero to bring back the idea of
yeah, but this material. Must be from the 70s.
Well, it is from the 70s, but they saw them in the early 80s. I'm talking Julian Schnabel, David Sally. They would have seen them in the late 70s when they were made. But, you know, I've talked to them, and they all thought, well, here's a guy who's taking all of this bricolage, all of this material, trying to regenerate painting with material And they were, you know, these were the so-called neo-expressionists. And you were sort of deconstructing the space of painting in a way. I mean, when you look at, when you see this, it may look like a design, but these physical gestures are floating out in front of the picture. They're not sitting on the ground. I mean, it's fascinating to me to see how this, the gesture is actually a piece of material. It isn't, you know, a painted gesture.
Yeah, and it's on the ground. I mean, that's a tiny bit Pollock-esque.
Yeah, it is. That's true. This is a painting called Talladega that's in the show, and very, very dense with many, many, many layers. And the fact that it's titled Talladega, it's titled after...
There were a lot of... The paintings were called circuits, and they're about racing circuits, yeah, basically. Mostly Formula One, but that happens to be a stock car circuit.
And you've driven Formula Ones, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, sure.
Have you?
No, I've been to driving school, which is a lot different from it. And I wasn't invited... and I wasn't invited to test out either.
Well, I can tell you one of the scariest aspects of doing this exhibition was driving with Frank. Anybody who knows Frank knows that he drives very fast. And, well, I don't know, the police in your...
Let's go on to another topic.
So the, on the left is a photograph that Hollis Frampton took of you blowing a smoke ring. I don't know what the date of that would be, but it's an early indication.
Yeah, it's. I think I know when. I think that was on the studio on Walker Street.
Okay.
Anyway, so that would have been in the middle 60s.
In the middle 60s.
Yeah.
And so it shows this early interest of yours in the idea of smoke and how it articulates space. And then later, you did these more formal, I don't know if formal is the word, you built a box?
Yeah, we built a box and we photographed it. I blew the smoke in from one of the corners, and then we had the six sides had cameras. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to photograph them enough to be able to scan them and shape them. So we had six views.
And what you see here, if I'm correct, is there are mirror images of each other. Right? Is the one on the bottom, the two bottom, are those mirror images of each other?
It's not south, east, and west.
Okay.
And top and bottom. Six-eye.
And this painting, which is in the show, again, these slides, you're going to think that this is this big, but where do you see this in the show? This is a very amazing painting called St. Michael's Counterguard. To me, it looks like a materialized smoke ring, but that actually isn't the inspiration for it.
Yeah, and I think it's way before the idea. I mean, outside of just blowing. I mean, the idea of the smoke was to be able to see if we could model something, because at that time, sort of, computers were very big and they could do a lot and everything. But in essence, we really couldn't program the smoke to perform in different ways than it does when I actually blow it. You could say conventionally you change the conditions, the air, the moisture, and sort of all of those things. But it didn't work out because the smoke is made up of particles and the numbers get too big for the computers, at least at that time, or for their interest in doing it. So we went on.
And then the Moby Dick series that was inspired by a trip with your kids to an aquarium, and you decided to do... it's Melville's famous Moby Dick. You reread it after that trip to the...
aquarium, yeah. I that was something that was out there. But what I was interested in was you know, most of the things we did were flat. I mean, it's the flat plane. And one, it really becomes ultimately an issue of topology, which is curved surfaces and how they react, or how you react to them, actually. And so that was a way of... most of the constructions, certainly before this, were essentially planar. And this was a way of changing the plane in a certain way. And obviously, once you do that, then you're really tempted to deal with the thicknesses and with the way the topologies can interact. So it becomes more complicated, but in a way interesting.
Well, I mean, it's a great homage to Melville's, you know, 1851 novel. And Melville's book had 135 chapters, and you did at least one work for each chapter.
That's true, but it wasn't... I only did it out of a kind of perverse reason, I guess. when I mentioned to one of my... children that I was going to do 135, one for each chapter, but it would seem too daunting. So, but he said it doesn't matter. You don't have to do them all. And that whole idea that I didn't have to do them all was just overwhelmingly challenging. I don't know why, coming from your own children.
So, of course, you know, what I see in the Moby Dick series a lot of, and there's a temptation when you take a book and then you translate it into an abstract language to try to connect the narrative to this abstract language. And, you know, I haven't been able to connect really specific things, but I certainly see a lot of water imagery. And and this work particularly fascinates me because it's called The Blanket, and that's a chapter in Melville in which the narrator talks about the fact that when the whalers were cutting whales up, they discovered that they couldn't quite figure out how many layers of skin they had, that they would go through, and some of them were translucent and some of them weren't. And to me, that seemed like a really good metaphor for your approach to painting. All of these different skins, you know, all the layers that you put into your paintings. And then you directly refer to a famous painting.
I think actually I was trying to finish with Moby Dick, but I was still working the same way. And then I couldn't find a title that I could tie this to Moby Dick, or it didn't come to me right away. So then I thought of The Raft of the Medusa.
By Jericho, which is mm-hmm. But it does, I mean, it, you know, the composition does feel like those bodies moving up the mast of this
Well, it had a kind of raft-like quality, I don't know, mm-hmm. just largely owing to the way we ended up putting it on the...
I mean, these are some details of Raft of the Medusa, in which you see Frank using molten metal almost as paint, which kind of refers back to the aluminum paintings.
Yeah, I mean, molten metal and paint. I mean, it's a question of material that you work with, but there's something about technically casting. Always becomes hard, but when the material is molten and viscous, I mean, it's really, it does a lot, and if you just, it lends itself to a painterly expression.
Can you tell me how this painting was made, Frank? I still try to figure it out, and I know it has something to do with computer.
Well, you have to know the people who made it. It's a collage. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a painting of a collage, basically. And so the collage is photographed, and then it's projected in sections on a canvas, so it's enlarged in that way. And then it's basically copied. Okay. But it's all paint. And so what looks like collage on the piece is just thick layers of paint.
Mm-hmm.
Some which were actually collaged onto the other layers of paint.
Am I wrong to see remnants of the smoke rings in this?
No, they're there.
That's
kind of literal.
And then this is the last slide we'll show, but this is from the Scarlatti series that's named after a Baroque harpsichordist named Domenico Scarlatti.
Yeah, a composer, yeah, and player, performer. Yeah.
So in this case, we're talking about using material and space to create an analogy to music, to sound, maybe?
I don't think so. I hope that some of it comes through. I mean, it's color, okay? So, yeah. And people do talk about the color in music. But the real attraction to Scarlatti is that this music or the harpsichord sonatas are really popular music. It's basically dance music from the street. And that's what I'd like the way... That was the kind of attraction that it was... It was music, and whatever it had in it, it was not very esoteric, or well, it is in a way because it turns out to be so good, I guess. But it wasn't really intended that way, although it was seen partly that way in the time in its time. But there were the other attraction was that, of course, Scarlatti began this work when he was 66 years old. And I got interested in it when I was probably 67 years old. I mean, it seemed like an idea that something that I could work with.
Well, that's the last slide I have. So I thought we could briefly open it up to questions for Frank.
You can answer some.
Or I could answer some.
Ferrari.
Nobody? Yes.
Are you still working in enamel paint?
Well, it's basically automobile paint, so it's an enamel. Yeah, I mean, but it's actually it was terrible. I mean, but it's water based now, so it's much easier to work with.
Go ahead.
Yes, when you were working with the smoke rings, have you given thought to trying to reproduce those using 3D printing?
Yeah, we have, but I mean, they're, you know, if you make something solid, that's made up, you know, something that's, as amorphous as smoke, it's okay. It's a kind of image, but, we don't have it, but we've modeled a lot of, images of the smoke rings, but they're interesting in that they're a little bit different, but they don't have much to do with smoke, finally, when you get done.
Hmm. Yeah.
How much of your work is actually made with your hand at this point?
Well, it depends on how you think about it. A lot of the pieces, the model making, a lot of the models... particularly something as complicated as this, which is a 3D model, are based on basically on a spiral piece of foam or something like that, and then later plastic that you cut out. And it's a two-dimensional image that you cut out and bend and twist, and that's what these are. So they're, when they're enlarged and everything, it presents a lot of different problems. But, I mean... I don't know what you're getting at, but what I can do with my hands. But the imagery, one way or the other, and the pieces are pretty much. I don't see them as not being hand driven, but that depends. I mean, for example, the poured metal. So somebody has to melt the metal, and someone has to pour it because. You know, I'd burn myself and maybe a lot of other people pouring it. But you know, I can draw in the sand and I can organize it and I can throw the things in on top of it. So there's a lot of physical involvement with the work. But again, after a certain point, there's you lose your reach and your rhythm and so you have to compensate for it, mainly in the model making.
But in the 70s, when you were making some of these monumental abstractions, surely you didn't paint all of those by yourself, right?
No, I didn't. But I mean, I was one of the people on the thing painting. I painted my side or my part or whatever.
Yes.
I
thought
I heard you say the phrase "avoid Picasso" and then. Context of the pinstripes?
No, it wasn't about the pinstripe. It was about the notion. It was about the notion of how you make a line, and the idea of making a line by letting the with Matisse letting the white canvas show through between the say a blue and a red area. That was the idea. If you had the same, say, two figures or a figure on the ground, that was Matisse's way of doing it. And that, of course, emphasized the color and made it sort of easy to make it big in a certain way. But if you were imagine that in the Picasso paintings, that you would have an outline of the image in black and it would change into something else.
So, Mr. Sill, I think it's fair to say that for the average museum goer, they're going to be a little bit confused, you know, looking at a piece like this, of why it's not a sculpture, it's a painting.
Nobody said it wasn't a sculpture.
How do you explain that to people?
I don't think it takes much explanation. I mean, if you say it's a, if you think of painted sculpture, say polychrome medieval sculpture, I don't see much difference between that and this. The only slight conceit here is that this piece is has an armature, and the armature is different from the is supporting the piece, and the armature could stand free, but it's leaning against the wall. I think it is important in the sense that the wall, in this case, is more probably like what Solowitz said. I mean, the wall becomes a kind of part of the piece.
But not
that necessary. But I mean, it needs a support. If it were freestanding, it would look pretty much the same if it were in a conventional space, like an exhibition space, like a gallery. If it were freestanding outside, it would probably be horrible. But that would only be because it's really hard to compete with Mother Nature, and it's very hard to compete with the average mall environment that it would be likely placed in. So in a gallery or in a museum exhibition space, you take advantage of the wall, the backdrop.
And you have said in the past, and I think it's really important to understand that, that sculpture has a pictorial side, just as painting has a sculptural side. So you can land on whatever side you want to land on, right?
Yeah, any way that works, as they say.
Yeah.
I was honored to see your exhibition at the Whitney in December. Now, it's curious, as you bring this show has been brought to this museum, how did this museum enhance and highlight your work?
Does it, or actually? I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, I think what she's asking is how has the show changed from the Whitney to here? And I think there are a few less pieces in this presentation. Also, this building is different than the Whitney building. I think this presentation, the presentation at the Whitney had an incredible amount of movement in it, partially based on the architecture and the way we all installed it. But in this building, I think things are framed a little more. So it's a slower view through Frank's work. But you haven't seen this show yet, so it's hard for me to...
I don't think that... it's inevitably different, but that what's different is the exhibition as a whole, or how you think that you, or I would think that I experienced the whole work, body of work. You know, I think it's worth saying something about what Malraux said about, he used Van Gogh as an example, and he said, you know, we worry about the intensity of the individual works and how we see his work and how we think about it. But But for Van Gogh, what was important was the ensemble, the whole thing, the vision he had of not his individual works, but of how they all fit together as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what exhibitions like this do, or that's the question that they raise anyway.
I was curious, so this whole time we've been coming off the wall, we've been building into this more sculptural. Would you ever consider going back to the wall, or back to a more
I have a lot of hints about how great flat paintings are and how good, and how cheap canvas really is on a stretcher. No, but that the large painting that we showed, the earthquake in Chile, that's basically a very conventional flat painting. It just happens to be quite heavy and quite big, but it's a painting in a very conventional sense.
So do you ever see yourself though, retracting back? It's very forward. It's always proficient. I don't know. But do you ever see yourself pulling back into a less dimensional painting.
Well, look, if you have you're talking about whether the painting should be flat, but if the surface that you're working on is flat, okay, but there's very little painting or surfaces that are flat that painters don't deal with in some kind of way, in which, de Kooning said it. It's about flatness, but you have to have, but where's the volume? And so It's almost instinctive, one way or the other. Volume needs to be expressed, and so there's a modest advantage if you're worried about that kind of problem to just accepting it, and then paint on the volume that actually exists.
I think we can leave it at that, Frank. Thank you so much. Thank you.